This is the podcast for Physics 2017 Introductory Modern Physics for 21st of February 2007. You review for us, Jacob, kind of the overall strategy of where we've been, not the details, just what the main points were, what's kind of the pathway through the material that we're doing here in Chapter 6.
Well, I guess we started out with the wave equation.
Okay, we invented the wave equation.
We looked at a time-independent version of it.
Okay. When do you get to use the time-independent version?
When the psi function can be separated into two functions, one of x and one of t.
Okay, what physically is the case for that?
Potential isn't changing?
Yeah.
Right.
Good.
When the potential is only a function of x and not a function of t, then you try to separate the variables and it works. Okay. So then we figured out what f of t was, e to the minus I omega t. And so the next thing is to figure out what psi is for specific cases. What case did we examine yesterday, Teresa?
The infinite well potential or whatever that case.
Yep.
So you have infinite potential outside the zero inside of it.
Right. And what did we conclude about that case, Marty Lynn? What does the wave function look like? Sine?
It's continuous.
We won't even say sines and cosines because the boundary conditions eliminated the cosines.
Mm-hmm.
So just sines. Just one sine?
I don't know.
How many wave functions work?
A bunch.
A bunch?
If the ends are zero.
Yeah. So if you get the right sine function...
They don't have to be continuous because it's an infinite special case.
Doesn't have to be continuous at the boundaries.
Right.
Or that is to say,
smooth.
It's zero both at the boundaries and outside, but we don't worry about the derivative being continuous. So we get wiggles, we get sines, and depending on what n is, you get more wiggles or fewer wiggles, and they all work as long as the wavelength fits into your box.
But does it have to be continuous in between the ends, though? It's just at the ends... doesn't have to be?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yep. Another consequence of the results that we obtained is that the energy is quantized. And so we computed the quantized energy levels, and they turned out to be the same thing that we got in Chapter 5. So the wave functions looked like they did in Chapter 5. The probability density things, the psi squareds, looked like they did in Chapter 5. The energy levels... look like they did in Chapter 5. It all makes total sense.
Okay, I have a question, and maybe it's whatever. It just says that in here that these functions, they explain the physical observables. So what physical observables specifically do they mean? It says, you know, that these wave functions can be used to determine the physical observables.
Where are you reading?
6.3. And so then they go up on these cases. So, but I mean, to me, maybe I just needed to reread it again. Do they mean where they find it? Because they do the probabilities or densities or what physical observables are they talking about?
It lists them on 192 in the second paragraph. It says has physical observable in bold.
Position, linear momentum, angular. Okay.
Yeah. All right.
Good.
So the position is one you mentioned, and that's certainly one we computed the expectation value for. And the expectation value was in the middle of the box. And then we did the momentum, and because it's a vector, the expectation value for it was zero because equal numbers of arrows to the left plus equal numbers of arrows to the right. Squared momentum isn't zero, the expectation, however. That's where we ended. We computed some expectation values, and we put the operator in between the psi star and the psi in the integral. And we integrated from negative infinity to infinity, but if it's zero everywhere except in the box, you really only have to integrate from zero to L, and you still get everything. We went through that in painstaking detail, line by line, in the book, and I hope it was helpful. I know Jacob's got a lot of notes in his book. Miles claims to still be confused.
Are you saying you don't believe me?
Yeah.
I really understand it all?
You're a pretty smart guy. Before we go on to the finite square well potential, do you have any questions you'd like to ask? The difference here is that the well is finitely deep, and it stops at some value V naught, so it doesn't go up forever. It's not infinite. And I don't know that we can afford the time to go through this in all of the excruciating detail that we did before, but I do want to highlight some interesting things. The potential is given here. It's like the last one, only it doesn't say infinity there. It just says V sub zero. And so in regions 1 and 3, the equation, Schrödinger's wave equation, becomes this, and that's what we have to solve. However, you can rearrange those things, finding all of the constants together. The energy is a constant, V naught is a constant, the 2m and the h bar squared is a constant. And so you can come up with a different differential equation. Let me flip back here and remind you of the one we used last time. It was this one right here. We have the second partial with respect to x of psi is equal to a negative constant times psi. And we said, oh, we've seen that differential equation before. We know what the solutions are. There are sines and cosines. We actually saw those back in our discussion of harmonic motion last semester. And then we went through the boundary conditions and eliminated the cosines, and that's where we ended up with the sines. The new differential equation looks somewhat similar. Second partial with respect to x, only they've now got this as a total derivative because there's no t's in there, is equal to a positive constant times psi. The negative sign is the only difference here. This constant, I think it was written as a k squared in the last case, this constant is all of this stuff up here that they just rearranged from the Schrödinger equation at the bottom of page 198 in equation 637. They just collected all the constants together and called them alpha squared, and that's what the equation is. So now the question is, what kind of functions do you know about that don't introduce the negative sign when you take the derivatives to get the second derivative? The sine does, and the cosine also does. If you take two derivatives, you get a negative sign out of each one of those if you take two derivatives. So they were solutions to the old equation. What's going to be the solutions to this new equation? Exponentials are what we think of that give you the very same function back again. If you do it twice, you still get the very same function back. The chain rule may give you a constant out front, but that's okay because we've got one to take care of that. The alpha squared can take care of whatever comes out from the chain rule. But we want exponentials as the answer to this question. And it could be a negative exponential too, because in the second derivative you'd get two negatives out, and that would be okay. That means in region 1, we have some kind of exponential function, because this is in regions 1 and 3. This is the equation, and the solutions are these. This says this is region 1. Why do we have that instead of this one? How do we know which one goes to which region, I guess is my question. How do they know the positive exponential is region 1 and the negative exponential is region 3?
Because it has to go to 0 as x goes to infinity.
Either direction. That's right. That's one of our four criteria for valid wave functions that we talked about the other day, back in the early part of the chapter. The wave function has to decay away as you go out to infinity in both directions. So in region 1, to get something that's going to decay away as you go over here to infinity, it needs to be an exponential. In region 3, to get something that decays away in this direction as you go out to positive infinity, it needs to be a negative exponential or decaying exponential. So that's how they knew which was which. So far, so good. Now, inside the square well, and again, I'm not trying to go in the same level of detail. I'm trying to highlight the differences from the last case. Inside the square well, the potential is zero, and we're actually back to the same case we had before. And we already know the answer to this is sines and cosines. This is what we did before. This is still going to be true. However, to match things up with the solutions outside of the well, what we want to do is write the solution instead of sines and cosines in an alternate form. You can write sines as a couple of complex exponentials. In fact, I think Appendix 3
might remind us of that, if I could remember and find it quickly. There's a sign, that's on page A4, in appendix 3. It's an expression for the sine, and another one for the cosine, but use that one. Anyway, it means that we can express sines as complex exponentials, and that'll help us match stuff up. Now, what is interesting about this new situation with the finite potential well is that, as we already saw mathematically right here, the solutions in the walls are not zero. Wow, that's kind of amazing already. It looks like this, meaning that we've got a sinusoidal thing inside of here, but it isn't zero at the walls. So when you match them up, you get different boundary conditions. You can see that these waves are a little stretched. This wave is a little bit longer than the wave would have been if it had to be zero here and zero here. And this wave, with the node in the middle, this wave is also a little longer. The wavelength of this wave is a little longer because it seeps into the wall, longer than the case of the infinite potential well. And so it doesn't have to be zero at the boundary conditions. However, our conditions require, for a finite potential well, require the old continuity stuff that we didn't have to worry about last time. So not only does the function have to be continuous, but the derivative needs to be continuous. It's got to be smooth as we go. So we need to match up the derivative of the function inside the well with the derivative of the function inside the wall of the well. So you use those boundary conditions to determine your coefficients, A, B, and C, and D, and everything, make sure everything works out. I just want to simply emphasize the fact that the wave function leaks into the wall and is not confined to the well. This is not something we see classically. We never would have dreamt about having a wave on a string extend beyond the length of the string. And these are particle waves, but they are not actually confined completely inside of the potential well box that they're in. This is really, really weird. And if you square these wave functions, they didn't do that in this particular picture like they did in the previous case, but you would see that there's a non-zero probability of finding the particle in the wall as opposed to inside of the well. It's truly strange.
So is that saying then that those physical things that we were talking about, position, angular momentum, all that, they're measured outside the potential well or whatever?
Yes, you'd still have to do the integral of psi star times the operator times psi to find the expectation value if you want to find out, you know, where you're most likely to expect to find it. But just psi star times psi itself, without any integral or any operator in between, is the probability of finding it at different places. And this is non-zero here, and so if you square it, you'll still have a non-zero thing, which means that, yeah, exactly what you said. There's a non-zero probability of finding the particle outside of the box.
Strange.
Yes. I had hoped you'd say that. They talk about how much it's going to be outside the box. There's this little equation here. In terms of the parameters given in the particular wave function, whatever V naught and E is, kind of tells you how far outside the box it will be. They call this little penetrating a distance greater than this little delta X. That's kind of the penetration depth into the wall. And you can see that you can get them as large as 10 over alpha or 20 over alpha, or, you know, depends on the situation. Now, if V is high, that is to say, if V minus E is a big number, then that means that it penetrates into the walls of the well less. The denominator is bigger, then this thing is less. So the higher the walls, the higher the potential well, or the deeper the well, we could say, the less likely it is to penetrate into the walls. But it still can some. That wasn't the same level of detail we did last time, but I hope that you follow through the main ideas, at least, and maybe work through the details on your own, but I wanted to highlight the differences between the infinite and the potential well. Any questions now, Miles?
Probably.
So, by having the H-bar in there, says that there's only certain distances outside of the box that the wave can be, like your little, the delta X.
Well, No, I wouldn't say that. It's not. We're not quantizing.
Where you can find it.
Where you can find it. What the H-bar comment they make in the last paragraph of that section is that it is not surprising that the penetration distance, which violates classical physics, is proportional to Planck's constant. If Planck's constant were a bigger number than it is, if you lived in a different universe where God dialed in the H-bar dial to a bigger number, then the penetration depth into the walls would be bigger, and maybe if it were big enough, then this stuff wouldn't be strange, as Teresa said. It would be common sense to have particles appearing outside of your box. It is because H is small that the penetration depth is small, but we're not claiming that it can only be found at certain positions out there. We're claiming that the likelihood of finding it out there is proportional to H bar. So in our universe, H bar is fixed, and so it only can depend on the other parameters in that equation. But if you compared universes, ones with larger H bars would have greater penetration depth. Now, that doesn't mean the particle only goes out this far, delta x, and then stops. It's just kind of a general idea of how, overall, how far it's going to penetrate in this picture. It's kind of an indication of how rapidly this exponential is decaying away. It doesn't mean that you can't find it past delta x. It's just that's kind of a characteristic distance where most of them will be inside of delta x. But it doesn't. This doesn't get to be zero at delta x. Does that make sense?
Yeah, still. I guess I'm more kind of wondering about, we had the, represented the particle as a wave, or well, in the box, so that it could only have, could only be like a standing wave at the certain ends, like, well.
Yeah, that's true.
To quantize it, but.
Quantize the energy.
Yeah,
but you can still find it anywhere in the box.
Yeah, that makes sense, but for the wave functions to go outside of the box, that still doesn't change the energy quantization.
The energies are still quantized, but it does lower them slightly, as you can see in this picture.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that the wavelengths are longer, remember de Broglie's wavelength thing, longer wavelength means smaller energy.
Okay.
So the energy levels are depressed slightly, but they're still quantized by the H-bar that's in that formula.
Okay. And I was just wondering if the H-bar and the delta X formula was related to that.
Well, it's the same H bar. It's the same H bar, but we're not claiming that you can only find it outside the wall at certain places.
Yeah.
That's not what the delta X means.
I understand that. I just
okay.
Trying to relate the ideas. Guess.
Okay, well, let's switch to the computer, Marty Lynn, and let's just review the same thing in these other notes and see if that does us any good to do that. It's the same thing, finite potential, V naught, region 1, region 2, region 3. There's a finite probability of finding it outside the well. That's the strange thing. Here's the calculation for it. That alpha squared is all this stuff multiplied by that. And so this is just a review. There's the same alpha that is. And there's the other, the negative decaying exponential. Region 2, we still get sines and cosines like we said, like we did before. But then does this... Okay, this guy who wrote these notes does not recast this solution as complex exponentials like Thornton and Rex do in equation 640. This is a legitimate solution to this equation, to the equation when there's a negative sign there. It doesn't show you the equation. But it's the same equation we had before, so sines and cosines are okay. And then you can still match up the coefficients by matching the wave functions and the derivatives of the boundaries. That's another part of the criteria for valid wave functions. We said they had to be single-valued. That means if you look at the value for x equals 0 or x equals L, it can't take on two different values, one that's kind of the limit from inside the wall and the other the limit from in the well. They have to be the same. It can only have one value at the boundaries of the well. And so we have to match up the wave functions. And they have to be smooth, so we match up the derivatives too. You can do that with sines and cosines. Our guys did it with the exponentials, but it's equivalent. Here's the next one, the next section. Not much new in here except the dimensions. you can kind of see that if you throw these two pieces away, you have the Schrodinger time-independent equation in one dimension that we did before, and then just put in the y direction, the z direction. And if you've had Calc 3, you may have seen the Laplacian operator. It's another differential operator, but it's in three dimensions. You also saw that in my little essay on the classical wave equation.
I do have another question. It said, with looking at things, you know, it's proportional to Planck's constant, the, you know, the
penetration depth.
Penetration depth. It says it's consistent with the uncertainty principle, and they say it's because in order for the particle to be in that barrier region, the uncertainty of the energy must be very large. When I look at that, I don't see why that's implied. Just if you get a probability in that equation, why does E have to be? I didn't know what they were talking about. It's right on page 200, right under that equation. You see what I'm talking about?
I do.
So what am I not noticing? They say it like it's very obvious, so I'm sure it is, but I don't see it.
They do that occasionally. Stuff isn't completely always obvious to me either. For example, this result is also consistent with the uncertainty principle because in order for the particle to be in the barrier region, the uncertainty of the energy must be very large. I don't know.
Just because they mean that the position is such a small position, you know the position, so you don't know it's not, I don't know.
Yeah, but that would be the uncertainty relationship between position and momentum, and that would make sense, too.
But this is energy, not
this
momentum.
Is energy and time, so I do understand the next sentence, the last sentence, where it says this can happen for a very short period of time because there's an uncertainty relationship between energy and time. The last sentence makes sense, but I'm not quite sure why they relate delta E to the depth, the penetration depth. In 3D... we need to use the three-dimensional Laplacian there, and the solution then is going to be the product of three sine functions. The wave has to fit in the L1 direction, the wave has to fit in the L2 direction, and the wave has to fit in the, you know, the Z direction in L3. Those are the boundary conditions. And just like we said, the solution had to be zero at the boundaries back in the one-dimensional case, that's the case here too. This is, by the way, an infinite potential well, and so the potential is, you know, totally infinite. That means the wave function is zero outside the well. So we expect just regular old sines and cosines that match up zero on the boundaries. The picture, though, is worth mentioning that occasionally we're going to have to envision more dimensions than we can draw. Of course, the screen is a two-dimensional physical object, but we fool ourselves with this perspective drawing into thinking we see three dimensions, but we really, that's not sufficient. We really need to see a fourth dimension because we're not seeing the height of the well here. We're only seeing the dimensions of the box. And back here, we only saw one dimension in space, and then the height of it was given as the potential. We could have conceivably drawn kind of a perspective square box down thing down here that would have been, you know, a square hole with X in one direction and Y back into the page and still had a height for the potential that would show that. But you can't do that in this case. All they're showing is the spatial dimensions of the box, not the height of the walls of the potential at all. It doesn't show up on this graph at all because you need a fourth dimension to do it. Don't know how to fix that except to try and get you to think in four dimensions.
I'd rather not. I'm already confused enough as it is. I don't want to do that.
Miles, don't underestimate yourself. I can get you to think in four dimensions in 1 hour. I won't do it today, but I promise you I can do it.
Okay, but I'll forget the last three chapters to fit that into my brain.
Ah! There's only so many neurons.
Mm-hmm.
And your brain's full.
Mm-hmm.
Need a memory upgrade, huh? Me too.
We'll put in some chips and see if you can hold the 4D stuff. Anyway, the wave functions, the sine part of each one, doesn't have to be the same if L1 and L2 and L3 are not the same, because it needs to fit in each dimension. Again, you have to imagine, it's difficult to draw the wave in here. It's easy to draw a sine function in one dimension,
A little tougher in two, but now you actually have to think of a three-dimensional sine function whose value is zero on every side of this box, because it has to match up to the boundary conditions, which are zero outside the well. So you need to be thinking that in its lowest mode, it would only have half a wavelength, that in its lowest mode, it would have half of a wavelength in the L1 direction, but that would also be true in the L2 direction, but it wouldn't necessarily be the same length as L1, and also be true in the L3 direction, or Z direction, but it wouldn't necessarily be the same length as L1. So you need to take this picture and zap it out of the page and then in another perpendicular direction and imagine a half wavelength in each of those three different size dimensions of this box. Pretty cool, eh? That would be the lowest state. Now, could you have excited states? Well, obviously, there are excited states here and here, but you have to be able to do that in each of three dimensions. You have to still keep in your brain this three-dimensional box that started out with a sine wave, a half a wavelength in each of the three dimensions. Now you have to keep it that way in two of the dimensions, but kick it up into the next state. This would be the first excited state above the ground state in one of the dimensions. Maybe this is the Y dimension, so L2 is this long, and you'd have an excited wave that's got two half wavelengths in the Y direction, but would still only have half a wavelength in the X and some other length Z direction. This gets pretty hard to see. Of course, you could have another version where it's in the lowest state in the Y and Z direction, but you've kicked it up into the second or third state in the X direction. It gets pretty tough. Now, you can imagine that if all of the three sides of the box are the same length, that would be a special case, but it would be an important special case. If all of the three, here are the energies for the different states. Notice you don't just have an N, you have to subscript them. N1 corresponds to the L1 direction in the box, the X direction, whatever. The N2 and the N3 correspond to the Y and Z directions. And that means that you can have a ground state in the X direction, but have an excited state in the Y direction and a different excited state in the Z direction. And it would be, like I said, hard to visualize what those sine waves on higher orders might look like in 3D. But take the special case of where they're all the same. That's this case right here. If they're all the same, then that L squared up there factors out and just comes out in front here. And you still have the possibility, even though the lengths are now all the same, you still have the possibility that it might be in different excitation states in the different directions. So what would be the first excited state? Well, it might be hard to say, huh?
Wouldn't you have to say in what direction? Unless, I guess you could define it as all if they're the first, if they're all ends are one.
If all ends are one, that's not the first excited state, that's the ground state.
Yeah.
So the one above that, if you know, what's the state above the one where all of the ends are one?
One of them's one, one of them's two.
Where two of them are one and the other one's two.
So what if one's one, or one of them's two, and then the other two are three?
That'd be another excited state.
But we can't really, I don't know. You can't say, like, you can't order it, like, one, two, like, the excited states, one, two, three, four, five.
Well, yeah, you can.
Oh, just kidding.
But no, you can't.
Oh, okay.
But yeah, you can. Right. Look, if...
You can order something any way you want. You're a mathematician, you should know.
Miles is going to go pull all his hair out. Say... Smith's led me astray this whole time. The world really doesn't make any sense. Suppose that N1 is 1, and N2 is 1, but N3 is 2. So you'd have 1 squared plus 1 squared plus 2 squared. I can add that up. That's 6. And I can multiply that by all that stuff. That's not too tough. I can do a 6. Now, if this one is 1, and this one is 2, and this one is 1, I can do that too. And what do I get? I get 1 squared plus 2 squared plus 1 squared. I get 6 again. Or, in a different state, let's say that N1 is 2, N2 is 1, and N3 is 1. So I get 4 plus 1 plus 1, I get 6 again. These are different states, but they have the same energy. And they are therefore called degenerate states. Physically different wave functions in the different dimensions, but they have exactly the same energy. So they're all the same amount excited above the ground state. They're degenerate in that sense. However, Miles, if you had one of them that's a 2 and the others are 3, well, you can add those up as well. 2 squared is 4, 3 squared is 9, another 3 squared is 9, add those up to 18, and add up to 2 squared, you get 22. That is clearly higher than 6. So you can order these by just running the numbers. The ends are integers. They're counting numbers. And you can square them and add them up. A bunch of them will give you the same value. They're all degenerate states energy-wise. They all have the same energy, but they're technically correspond to physically different wave functions. But if they're different energies, you can, in fact, then order the different energies. Now you understand why I said you can order them, or you can't, or you can. Degenerate ones all aren't ordered, but you, if they're not degenerate, you can. Is this weird stuff? How are you going to make a physically of three-dimensional potential well? I mean, a regular water well out in the country, you know, your Farmer Joe drawing up water out of the ground, that's a well, but it's only like 2D in space, plus the third D is the depth. We're using this third D depth as our value of the potential. So you need to add a dimension onto that. You need to think of three-dimensional space that then has a fourth-dimensional depth that corresponds to the value of the potential. Is that hard?
Oh, that's, I've been doing that since kindergarten.
You do that since linear algebra.
Oh, and that one.
You are probably used to multiple dimensions from linear algebra. At least
this doesn't mean
at least
I
trying to think of
picture.
R sub n.
Yeah.
But a well, that's another little thing. You didn't think of wells in linear algebra. Okay, I'm through with the finite potential well. How about you?
Sure.
Tell me how it's different from the infinite potential well.
Well, what do you want to know about the difference? Because there are many things that are different.
Switch back to the computer, please.
It can go outside the walls.
Okay, that's a significant difference.
It's exponential outside the walls.
Okay,
inside the walls,
it's decay.
A sine wave function.
Okay. Those are all good. That's what I would have said. It's clearly non-classical. The quantum mechanics allows it to be in classically forbidden regions. In fact, when I made up the key to the quiz yesterday, that's what I wrote for that last question. What do we mean by tunneling? I said it means that the quantum mechanics permits particles to be in classically forbidden regions.
It could be. It will be as far away as you want it to be, given enough time, too, won't it? Because the probability goes clear out there, so if you want it to be like in another galaxy,
exponentials never get to zero.
Then,
yeah,
right. It's eventually going to.
Yeah.
But still, it can only get so close to one. So I was thinking if we've
so close to what?
So close to one, right? It's getting closer and closer and closer to zero. I mean,
to zero. Okay.
Not to one, but to zero.
Yeah.
I mean, when, isn't there a spot where it can't be because it's too big to be there?
That closer and closer to zero isn't telling you how big it is. It's telling you the probability. Well, the wave square of the wave function is telling you the probability, and that never gets to zero. Well, we'll come back to that, but let's do... did you see these degenerate states? The ground state, if they're all one, is this one, but then the first excited state, these are exactly what we said, and they would all have the same energy. There's the 6 that we got out of that, and these three states are degenerate. Okay? How about the simple harmonic oscillator? And why do we care about them? Because lots of potentials in nature are harmonic, at least in a narrow range, or that is to say, it's a good approximation over some regime of the problem. Not everything stays harmonic all the time. For example, there's a picture at the bottom of page 203 that is the potential of a diatomic molecule. In fact, maybe we better look at that. Can you switch back for just a second? We'll be going back and forth because I want to go back to the computer too. But here's the picture. And you'll probably get used to seeing lots of pictures kind of like this. A lot of them have this type of shape. This is a picture of the potential, or potential energy they even say here. And the blue line is the real potential of the diatomic molecule. And what it says is that if you're about this far apart, your two atoms in the molecule,
There's an attractive force. If you're over here, there's an attractive force that keeps those together. But if those two get too close together, then there's a repulsive force. So they don't land on top of each other and smash each other. It says there's a kind of a natural distance that those two atoms would like to be apart, and it's this R-naught distance here. Any further than that, and they're attracted together. Any closer than that, and they're repelled apart. And it kind of decays away like this as well. It is not a parabola. However, you can see that it can be quite well approximated by a parabola with the dotted line there. And the parabola, the parabolic potential gives us simple harmonic motion. I hope that was made clear last semester as well. Anytime you have a potential like this, then you get simple harmonic motion. So this isn't technically simple harmonic motion, but it's pretty good, at least between here and here. Looks like the dotted line and the blue line are about on top of each other in that range. So I'd say that for a while, at least, we can approximate this diatomic molecule as a simple harmonic oscillator.
Does the blue line go off that way because after it gets too far away, it sort of follows an inverse square type thing?
Yes.
Would that be okay? I'm trying to review some basic physics, I guess.
Yeah. Here's a parabola, and if the system has a certain amount of energy, E, then the particle can oscillate back and forth between these two turning points. That is to say, at this point right here, all of its energy would be potential energy, and it would have no kinetic energy, and the same would be true on the other side. We studied this last semester. We called these turning points. Does that term ring a bell? Turning points. And down here, it would have no potential energy. It's zero at the bottom. But it would have a lot of kinetic energy. And so the object, the ball rolling in the bowl, could oscillate back and forth between the two turning points. So far, so good? We can describe this easily as a parabola. There is a parabola right there. Notice that if you take the negative derivative of this, you get this. That was another principle we learned. The negative derivative of the potential function is force. And if it's a parabolic potential function, then the negative derivative of that gives you a Hooke's law, linear restoring force. Either one of these should scream to you simple harmonic motion. If you ever see a force that's a negative, you know, a linear restoring force, you just automatically think, oh, that's going to be a simple harmonic oscillator. But likewise, if you ever see a potential function that's a parabola, you should always think, well, that's going to be a harmonic oscillator. Because these mean the same thing. The negative derivative of the potential is the force. So if this is a parabola, this is a line. Well, there's the V. You're putting it into Schrodinger's equation. This is the time-independent Schrodinger equation. And there's V right there in the purple. Now we've got to find a psi. This is lowercase psi. We need to find a psi of x that satisfies this differential equation. Isn't this sweet? I just can't get over this. Now, think about what we've done. We've used up all of our good functions, haven't we? I mean, the simplest case we started with was the infinite potential well. We had a very nice, as a result, you know, the Schrodinger equation turned out to be a very nice, very simple, second-order, ordinary differential equation where it was proportional to itself. Then we did the finite potential well and found in regions 1 and 3 it was a little stranger in that it was a second-order differential equation that was proportional not to a negative constant but to a positive constant, so we had to use our other standby, you know, what's the second derivative that's equal to it, the original function? So we used exponentials there. Well, now we have a new potential function, new potential well, given by this 1/2 kappa x squared. And it's a new differential equation. It is a new differential equation. Switch back to the book, please. Oh, no, don't. It's right here. This is the differential equation. Can you see how if you take the size out, you know, factor them out, that you could collect all the constants and turn it into a differential equation of this form, okay? You could have to multiply the h bar over and all that stuff, but you could do it. You could make the second derivative of the function with respect to x be equal to
something times itself, but it's a more complicated thing than we had before. It's not just a negative constant. It's not just a positive constant. It's all of it multiplied by itself. What are the solutions to this differential equation? Have you gotten to this in Diffie Q yet, Marty?
I think so.
This is called the Hermite equation.
Maybe not.
And it has solutions that are called Hermite polynomials. Oh, there are the constants right there. Just so you can see where they all went. You know, from up here, rearrange, rearrange, and you get this, but that's how the rearranging was done. The solutions are, you just can't wait till I pull this down, can you?
I'm so excited.
I mean, think about it. We've used up all the cool functions. What's cooler than sines and cosines? Nothing. And we've used them up. What's the next coolest thing? Maybe even more cool than sines and cosines, exponentials. We've used those up. We're not going to get those again because those were the solutions to a different differential equation. We've got to have new stuff, new functions that are solutions to this differential equation. Hermite polynomials. See if I can find the Hermite polynomials. There they are. That's what they look like. Now, you figured there wouldn't be just one of them. How many solutions to this differential equation are there? There are n of them, which is an infinite number because n's all the counting numbers. So there's a Hermite polynomial sub 1, there's a Hermite polynomial sub 2, et cetera, et cetera. And these are all valid wave functions for a particle in a parabolic potential well. And it will oscillate as a simple harmonic oscillator. And the wave functions are these guys, well, multiplied by that decaying exponential. Can you see those? Maybe I need to zoom in really close so you can see those. Oh, they've divided them to make them all fit on the same page. Those come from, going the wrong way. Those come from this book that's a compilation of mathematical functions. Maple probably knows about Hermite polynomials, and Mathematica probably does too, but your HP 89 probably doesn't. Maybe, I don't know. Maybe I'm underestimating your HP. But it's, this book is just tabulations of zillions of different functions that are so weird and non-normal that you can't find them regular $30 calculator. But they're useful. They actually mean stuff to certain people, including these Hermite polynomials. They are orthogonal. Well, let me show you the category at the top of the page. These are orthogonal polynomials, which you may have got some inkling of when you studied linear algebra. We talked about orthogonal vectors as a basis set to cover a space. Does this sound familiar? Yeah. Well, these are orthogonal polynomials, and they're like vectors. In fact, you can make vector spaces out of functions. You can have function vector spaces. And these are orthogonal ones, which means you can express any polynomial as a linear combination of the Hermite polynomials. And they're also solutions to this equation that we have. In fact, here's another book on the quantum mechanical simple harmonic oscillator. Let's zoom in on that. Does that look at all familiar?
A little bit.
The potential is 1/2 k. They use k instead of kappa. And they're using a z instead of an x. That's okay. And then they're going to plug it into, what's that? Schrodinger wave equation. Looks exactly like what we did. We know that there's some boundary conditions. This is one of our four conditions, that as you go to positive and minus infinity, the wave function has to die out, or it's not a valid wave function. So that's a boundary condition on the equation. And you solve the equation. Let's see, where do they get these? Well, they do it right here. There's the differential equation right there. That's the one I showed you on the computer screen with, you know, different constants. They call it lambda instead of beta and this instead of alpha. But this is the same differential equation that we have. And the solutions are these Hermite polynomials. Multiplied by the decaying exponential. Are they putting those on here? Anyway, what about the energies? So what about the energy levels? We expect them to be quantized.
in these quantum mechanical systems, so we're not going to be at all surprised to find that the energies are quantized. But I'll show you a picture of the energies.
The ground level can't be zero.
That's a point I want to make. There are the energy levels, E0, E1, E2, E3, for these various ends. Notice the wave functions themselves. Let me zoom in on that a little bit more. These are, in fact, those Hermite polynomials multiplied by this stuff out here is the decaying exponential that we mentioned. This is what ensures that the psi wave function decays as you go out to infinity in either direction. You can't have an infinite wave function. It's got to go to zero out to infinity, and these decaying exponentials are going to do that, take care of it, make sure that happens. But the rest of the stuff, that's the first Hermite polynomial, and there's the next one, and then there's the next one, and then there's the next one. But these are the energy levels, and Miles has found an interesting thing, and that is that the lowest energy level, the ground state, does not have zero energy. It's called the zero point energy. There's that much of it in the zeroth energy level, and you really can't ever get rid of it. There's no lower energy states. It can't jump down to a lower energy system. It's as low as it goes. But it isn't zero, and it's always there. So people write interesting books like this one. Could we use that energy for quantum mechanical systems? Could we tap the zero point energy and get free energy?
And anti-gravity.
And anti-gravity. Wouldn't that be sweet? Let's look at the pictures, too. These aren't lined up very well. I'm not quite sure why. It seemed to me like the copy editor of this book could have done a little better job. But there's the first wave function. It is the graph of, and by the way, I should probably do this in the graphing calculator program and send them out to you so you can see them for yourself in the graphing calculator. That's the graph of that wave function. And in fact, that e to the minus whatever that is, alpha x squared, that's going to be a Gaussian curve because that's all constant stuff right there. And that's exactly what that is. That's a Gaussian curve. That's the lowest energy, the lowest wave function. That's the ground state wave function. If you square that, you get this picture, which is not directly horizontally across from it. And I wish it were, but this is psi zero squared. And it looks kind of similar. This is now going to tell us about the probabilities of finding the particle. What are these dotted lines here for? Which look for all the world like not straight lines. Is that bent? That looks like it's not vertical.
They've really been weird.
Anyway, what do these dotted lines represent? Forgotten. They represent the turning points. Classically, back last semester, the marble in the bowl could never get to a greater distance away from the center than A, or negative A. The turning points were as far as it could go, because the kinetic energy was all zero, used up, and the potential energy was as much as you had. So for a given energy level, the turning points defined the limits. It really did turn around there and went back, classically. What we're saying here is the wave function extends past the turning points and has a non-zero probability of being outside of the potential well in the parabolic walls. This is the tunneling thing that we had with the finite square potential well too. Particle can be, and by the way, I should have said this before, but luckily I remembered it here now. It applies to the finite potential well too. We're not claiming that the particle is here or here or here, we're claiming that if we look for it, our instruments will make it be somewhere, and so we'll find it at one place. But before that, it wasn't one place. It was the whole wave. It was all the places at once. It wasn't at one location. It was the whole thing. It's the smeared out wave function. For the next wave function, the first excited state above the ground state, it's kind of interesting. That's a mathematical graph of this formula right here. And you see that that x right there is going to make the negative stuff go negative. And this positive, this stuff right here was the Gaussian thing, and it's still there.
the next x is positive on the right side and it's negative on the left side, and that's what you see in this picture. The next one, we better go look at the probabilities. Okay, so if we square this thing, and you could do that in the graphing calculator as well, square that thing, you would get this picture, which means, interestingly, as we saw before, there's zero probability of finding the particle in the middle of your parabolic potential well when it's in the first excited state. Now, if it's in the ground state, you have a high probability of finding it in the middle of the well. But if it's in the first excited state, you have a zero probability of finding it there. And on and on. We don't need to examine each of these quite so carefully, but you can see there's the psi sub 2, this next excited state, and it's a graph of psi sub 2. We could plug that in almost directly, just like that, into graphing calculator, and it would draw that. And its square looks like this. And on, there's the next one, and its square looks like this. What if you had n equals 10? Look at that. What does this tell us? This is the squared thing. So this is the probability distribution function. These are used to be dotted lines. They're now solid lines. These are the turning points. A, we still see that it can go outside the regular forbidden regions, the classically forbidden regions. B, you see 10 humps. It's wiggling up and down. What is the dotted line here, the curve?
Isn't that the classical idea?
That's the classical probability distribution. Why isn't it flat?
Because it slows down when it's up towards the top, so it spends more time there. So
Miles, you can never again tell me you don't understand
this
stuff.
I don't understand it.
You get it clearly. When we had a square potential well, the classical prediction was that it was probability same anywhere. It could be anywhere equally likely because it's, you know, all moving at the same speed. But in a parabolic potential well, if you think about a marble rolling in a bowl, Miles is exactly right. As it rolls up the sides, it slows down and actually spends more time there. And that's why the probability, classically, the probability of finding the marble up the side of the bowl is higher than it is to find the marble at the bottom of the bowl, where it's moving fast and therefore spends less time. We do believe that quantum mechanics should reduce to classical physics in the limit that n gets very, very, very large. And you can kind of see, to some extent, n equals 10 already doing that. I mean, it's basically, there's n equals 0, 1, 2, 3. You see more and more humps. There's 10. What if you had n equals 52,397? Well, you'd have a whole zillion wiggles back and forth, but it would very closely follow the classical dotted line. So that in the limit, as n gets very, very large, then we do expect to see the classical probabilities again. And you would not expect to see it outside the turning points very often in those high ends.
That's because things that we observe would be in a lot higher of excited state then, I guess.
Yep. In terms of multiples of h-bar, macroscopic systems that we can observe, like balls rolling in bowls, have n that's many gazillions.
Yeah.
Normalize, you know how to normalize the wave function? By integrating, you know, the thing from negative infinity to positive infinity and making that probability thing equal 1. So you can find out what the constants are, the normalizing constants. And they only have you do it for the ground state. And in fact, well, it's actually easier than it looks, because the ground state, the Hermite polynomial, is a constant. So there's the constant, and we have this exponential that we keep on all of these. I mentioned that too. It's on all of them. So there's the Hermite polynomial right there, but it's a constant. And so in the ground state, all you have to do is determine that constant by this normalization procedure. And they do that, and they get, voila, at the bottom, surprise, surprise, the exact, that's A right there, alpha over pi to the 1/4 power. And we've already seen that, because that's what I showed you over here on these. That they've already done it. There's the normalizing constant right there. So it's been normalized in this list already. But then, of course, you're supposed to go on and find the expectation value of x. Right here, there's psi star. There's the operator itself. But for the position, the operator is just x. And then it operates on psi. So you plug in what psi is, you plug in this thing, or the normalized version of it. You can better. Plug that in to this, and there you go. And you integrate that.
I have a question.
Yes.
While we're talking about that, I don't get what they mean when they're talking about finding the expectation values for when it's like x squared or p squared. What would that correspond to? Like, I mean, I can see the math of it, but I don't.
The last thing in this chapter is tunneling.
I can't go to sleep anymore.
What?
So we'll have to not let you go to sleep anymore. I'll sneak caffeine pills into your drinks.
Barriers and tunneling. There's a little barrier, and here's a particle that's coming by with an energy E, which is greater than the height of the barrier, is in height in energy. This is an energy potential graph. And classically, this particle could just zoom right on by. Quantum mechanically, you have to do the wave equation and solve it. You have to solve the differential equation, find the function that satisfies it. And because this is in Schrodinger's equation, the V is, you get non-zero solutions. And the particle doesn't just zip on by. If you solve this quantum mechanically, and we're not taking time to go through the math details this time, although it would be fun to do that, the result is that the particle gets reflected or transmitted with varying probabilities, depending on the height of the barrier. This is weird stuff. Notice that in region 1, the potential is 0. In region 3, the potential is 0. But in region 2, it's non-zero. So for the different regions, that's what I just said. And then you plug them into the Schrodinger equation, and you get these differential equations that you must solve. Without spending too much time on the math, there are the solutions. They're, again, complex exponentials. But you have to determine the coefficients for the boundary conditions and the relative height of E and V naught. And so you actually end up with incident and reflected and transmitted waves. That is to say, transmitted makes it over into region 3 and goes on its merry way, but the reflected wave goes back to the left in region 1. This is traveling to the right, this is traveling to the left. And you can even compute probabilities for the reflected wave and the transmitted wave in terms of those coefficients that we saw there. This means that if you send a particle into a situation that has a barrier like that, it might get by with some probability. But it might not get by the barrier, even though it's not high enough to physically stop it, you'd think classically, it might turn the particle around and send it back as a reflected particle with some probability. Strange stuff, okay? I think it gets a little weirder, though. If we look at a potential barrier where the energy is less than V naught. What did I mean to say? Less than V naught, yeah. Here's the drawing. We have the same type of barrier, only now the particle's coming in with energy. It's not up here. The energy is not greater than the potential barrier. It's less than the potential barrier. Classically, this is the picture of the classical version. Classically, this thing would just hit that wall and bounce back and be reflected every time. Classically, again, it maybe won't be so strange anymore after seeing the last case, but there's a finite probability of it actually transmitting through. You have to run all the three region wave equations, get their solutions, match up the boundaries to find the constants, and make the function match and the derivatives match, and you'll find out that there's a non-zero wave function over here, which represents the wave continuing on through the barrier. Classically, it would never do that. It's like throwing a ball at a brick wall, and it would always bounce back, classically. Quantum mechanically, it might get through. What does the wave equation look like? The Miles?
Oh, I was just going to say, so I guess that means that could happen then, because even though it's really improbable, you could throw a ball at a brick wall and just go through, you're saying?
Quantum mechanically, yeah.
Yeah.
Classical physics would never predict it.
So I'm waiting for that to happen.
You might be waiting a long time.
I'm going to wait for it.
Okay. Here's your wave function coming in. And it's sinusoidal. Here's the wave function on the other side of the barrier, and it's sinusoidal. And then, and I haven't, again, shown you the math, but remember those e to the
complex exponential things, inside of the barrier, there's still a wave function. It's a non-zero wave function, and in fact, it must match up the two other wave functions. You have to match the function and the derivatives on those boundaries, so you get a decaying exponential here that matches up to the sinusoidal here and matches up to the sinusoidal there. This represents then the tunneled particle that shows up on the other side of the barrier. It's in a classically forbidden region. It shouldn't be there classically, but it can be there, and it shows up, and this physically happens. Can we actually really measure this kind of stuff in real life? Can we see this happen? The answer is yes. They give an example of tunneling for a light particle, a photon. Normally you'd get total internal reflection here, but if you put up a second piece of glass with a small gap in between there, there is a probability, a non-zero probability, that it can tunnel across that gap and get over into the other piece of glass. We can see this. So it physically happens.
I have a question. I don't want to interrupt you. But just to be clear, I mean, a particle does one of the other, or does it do some combination of things? I mean, particles are kind of like waves. So, but when you're looking at this, either the particle, it had a high probability of being reflected, but if there still is a probability it went through, but it's just, you can think of it, it does one or the other. It's not like it does all three at once.
I want to hedge and say both. What I want to say, Teresa, is that if you try to measure the location of the particle, you will find it somewhere. You will find it either over here as a reflected particle, or you will find it over here as a transmitted, tunneled particle. You won't physically measure to see it in both places. However, that's because the measurement, I hate to say this, but I guess I better at some point. There are huge, huge philosophical issues about quantum mechanics that bug people no end, including luminaries such as Einstein, who never quite reconciled with quantum mechanics, for reasons such as this. And that is that we say, at least in the Bohr-Copenhagen interpretation of quantum mechanics, we say that the wave function collapses at the moment of measurement. And so it won't be in all three regions when you measure it. It'll only be in one place because you found it there. But until you measure it, it's all of the places. It's in the barrier, it's tunneled through, and it's a reflected particle. It's this smeared out wave function that only appears point-like or particle-like when you decide to pin it down and look for it. I hope that's mind-boggling to you.
Okay, well, I was sort of afraid you would say that.
Well, if it's not mind-boggling, then you didn't understand what I said.
Oh, it's mind-boggling.
Okay.
Don't worry about that part.
All right, well then.
I was just afraid you were going to tell me it was everywhere at once, but only one place at the time when you measured it.
That is what I'm saying.
I get that when you measure it, you interfere with it. So, I mean, that makes sense, but, yeah, how it's sort of two things, yeah, okay, but never mind.
I want to say exactly what you said. It's everywhere at once until you measure it, and the wave function collapses to be at one point.
Yeah, give you a headache. Maybe I'm with Einstein. I don't like it, really.
That's fine. That's fine. One last application, and then I think I'm going to be through here. I want to talk about alpha decay because it's so important to our universe. This is a potential function or one dimension of it. Well, let me back up one little comment. You remember when we were trying to visualize a three-dimensional potential well, we could get the box okay in three dimensions in our brain, but we couldn't imagine the fourth dimension to get the potential depth very easily. If they were all really the same, it would be a cubical box, but what if we even made it more symmetrical than a cubical box, then what if you made it a spherical box? Now, I don't know if this is easier to visualize or not, because you still need a 3D sphere to be the box, but you still need a fourth dimension to talk about the depth of the well. However, the symmetry is many-fold increased in a sphere versus a cubical box. The symmetry is so high that we don't even need to talk about X, Y, and Z anymore. We can talk about R. We're down to one spatial dimension, which we can easily graph like on this picture here. R is just the distance away from the center of your box in any direction, and it's totally spherically symmetrical. Now, if you pick one line out from the center and call that your r-axis, then you can use the height of the graph, again, like we wanted to graph the depth of the potential well. And that's what we're doing here, but you have to understand that this is spherically symmetric, and in reality, the physical box here is a sphere in 3D. It really is. This is a picture of a nucleus. And in a nucleus, there are a bunch of protons. And those protons hate each other with a passion. Coulomb says, get away. There's a Coulomb force law between those protons that says, like charges repel. And it's an inverse square law. So if we had a positive charge that was near this nucleus, it would feel a force pushing it away. By the way, remember that we said the negative derivative of this graph is the force. So the slope of something here is sloping down. The negative derivative, the negative slope, would be a positive force pushing it away. Does that make sense? The slope of this thing is negative, but the negative of the slope would be positive. So the force here is positive. That's why the proton, or whatever it is, gets pushed away. In this case, it's not just one proton. It's a pair of protons with also a couple of neutrons thrown in for good measure. This is called an alpha particle. That's all it is two protons and two neutrons. It happens to be a very stable configuration in nature, and so we do see them a lot. It also happens to be the nucleus of a helium atom, which is a very stable atom. Rip the two electrons off, and you have an alpha particle. So if you had an alpha particle near a positively charged nucleus, the alpha particle has a charge of plus 2, it would certainly feel a strong Coulomb repulsion force pushing it away from the nucleus. However, if it weren't just close to the nucleus, but were instead inside of the nucleus, this is a three-dimensional sphere, now, physically, dimensions, but the height now talks about the potential, it says that it wants to be inside now, and it's not being pushed away. And the alpha particle is fat and happy inside of the nucleus. It is part of the nucleus. And classically, that's the end of the story. It would stay there forever, even at an energy like this energy right here. If that alpha particle had that much energy, it's clearly, classically, confined to be in the nucleus forever. And you'd say, okay, atoms are stable. You know, a carbon atom is going to be a carbon atom 7 billion years from now, and a silicon atom is going to be an oxygen atom is going to be an oxygen atom 17,000 zillion years from now. They're stable, and this is why, because the potential well is very deep, and it's confined, classically. What does quantum mechanics tell us? It tells us that there's a wave function in here, and it's probably sinusoidal in here, and then it also decays, probably some kind of decaying exponential, in this barrier. This is like the rectangular barrier we just saw, only now it's a decaying inverse square law barrier, but it's okay, it's still a barrier, and it means that the wave function is non-zero in here because it's not infinitely high. If this went up to infinity, then the wave function would be zero in here. But for a finite potential well, then it tunnels into the barrier, and in fact tunnels through the barrier, and quantum mechanically, this alpha particle can occasionally, rarely, find itself outside of the nucleus. Now, to piggyback on Teresa's comment, the wave function is big in here and decays away and is very, very, very small out here, which means the probability of finding out here is very small. But as a wave, the alpha particle is all of those places at once. It is the wave. The wave isn't trying to describe the particle. The wave is the particle. So it's everywhere. But the point is, if you look for it out here, you will rarely, but occasionally, find it there. It will sometimes literally be there. Alpha particles, which would classically be confined for zillions of years, can just suddenly pop out of a nucleus. Do they do this often? No, they do not. But do they do it enough that we can see this in nature? And the answer is yes. Radioactive atoms
that emit alpha particles do it this way. Alpha particles come out of nuclei quite commonly in radioactive nuclear isotopes. It's not hard to find some of these. And this is how it happens. It's confined in there, but quantum mechanically it can get out and occasionally does. Now the reverse of this process, this is my concluding comment, is that if you have two alpha particles that want to smash together, they Coulomb repel each other big time. Two positive charges repelling the other two positive charges. They don't want to get anywhere near each other. But if you're in the middle of the sun, where there's bazillions of these guys zipping around, the Coulomb barrier is very high, and classically, they wouldn't overcome it. Hardly ever. But quantum mechanically, they can tunnel through this very barrier. And they can fuse together and become a bigger nucleus that's both alpha particles together. And that's what powers the sun. The sun wouldn't shine if it weren't for quantum tunneling.